Good evening and welcome behind the news for December 13, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Excuse my raspy voice, but got a bit of a lingering cold, so I'm not my usual dulcet self. And we've got two guests lined up for tonight. First, in a few minutes, we'll be speaking to Tom Gagin, who is a Chicago-based lawyer and author of several books. Including the quite successful and notorious Which Side Are You On? About how to be for labor when labor is flat on its back. And most recently, just out from the New Press, is the book See You in Court, about the litigation explosion and his view of what's behind it. Certainly the right wing has made a big deal out of how evil the litigation explosion is, and they're blaming liberals and the courts and all that sort of thing. But Tom Gagin has a different point of view on that, and we'll hear from him on just what that might be. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined in the studio by, I should say, Greg Grandin, who is a professor of Latin American history at NYU, and we'll talk to him about Venezuela, the referendum on the Constitution, but also just the general state of play in that country, what the politics, the economics, the revolutionary leadership of Hugo Chavez, and what it all means for the hemisphere and the world. That's Greg Grandin at the bottom of the hour. Before we get to all of that, a few words on the economic headlines or the economic news. Yet another action-packed week for both the real economy and the financial system that sits what prepositions do they use? Above, beyond, amidst, next to, astride, whatever, it. How much is the financial crisis that emerged from the subprime mortgage market and has spread around the world? How much is this affecting the real business of producing, buying, and selling actual goods and services? I'm sorry to say the answer isn't all that clear yet. Let's start with the stuff that matters most to average people, the state of the job market. On Friday, December 7, which happens to be the birthday of Willa Cather, Noam Chomsky, and me, the Bureau of Labor Statistics released its employment report for the month of November. Expectations were pretty muted, and those turned out to be mostly correct. The report showed a job market that's growing only modestly, and with a lot of the new employment coming in the part-time form. But it did show a strong gain in average hourly earnings, which complicates the Federal Reserve's job. They're sworn enemies of inflation, especially inflation in wages. So while the financial crisis and a slowing economy counsels ease, rapid and deep cuts in interest rates, as well as creative ways of pumping cash into the money markets, the inflationary threat of rising wages counsels the opposite. Of course, wages have been going nowhere to down for most of the last 35 years, but doing something about that, reversing it, that isn't high on the list of our ruler's priorities. A few more comments about the job market. Employers added 94,000 jobs in the month of November, a number that's almost certain to be revised, perhaps considerably, in the coming months. The long-term average monthly gain is more than 2.5 times that much, though, 250,000. So we're running well behind that norm. And the jobs were very narrowly distributed by industrial sector, with a third coming from the twin powerhouses of recent years, healthcare and bars and restaurants. Manufacturing and construction both lost jobs. The housing bust, which took some time to show up in the jobs numbers, is finally making its presence known. All in all, less than half the industrial sector's added jobs, a dismal share for what's supposed to be an economic expansion. This is not a recessionary report, but it's getting close to one. Then there's the inflation fear, a fear that was reinforced when the BLS released its report on producer prices this morning, prices at the wholesale level, that is, before they get to the retailer's shelves, up 3.2% just in the month of November. That's a monthly reading, not an annualized reading or not a year-to-year reading, but up 3.2 on the month, the second highest number in the 60-year history of the series. The rise was almost entirely the result of energy prices, which analysts often strip out to isolate underlying trends, but no one ever paid a bill for underlying trends alone. But even prices excluding energy put in above average gain of close to 5% on an annualized basis. So there's a touch of this 1970s about all this, stagflation or stagnation plus inflation, that is slow growth with rising prices, a policymaker's nightmare. As if things weren't complicated enough, there's a whole credit crisis to worry about. Last Tuesday, the Federal Reserve's Policy Setting Committee decided to cut the interest rates under its direct control by just a quarter of a point, and the statement released with that decision didn't exactly promise lots more to come. Wall Street had been hoping for more, like a half a point cut with a statement that promised the moon. This resulted in loads of complaints about how Fed Chair Ben Bernanke is deaf, dumb, in both senses, and blind, a mere academic who just doesn't understand the markets and so on. And then on Wednesday morning, the Fed, along with some of the major of its major foreign counterparts like the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, and the Bank of Canada, announced a joint operation that would provide loans to banks that had trouble raising funds through normal channels. There's a famous old adage about what to do in a monetary crisis that came from Walter Badgett, who was the editor of The Economist in the 1860s and 1870s. Lend freely, he counseled, against good collateral at penalty rates. That is, to get funds from the central bank when they're in a bind, banks would have to offer up good assets like government bonds or prime quality loans as collateral, and the central bank would in turn lend the cash, but at a rate high enough that it kind of hurt. The idea was to discourage banks from acting recklessly at the same time you were keeping the whole system from imploding. That's what this new central bank operation is doing. They're offering to lend money to banks and have a hard time raising it, but not for free. Wall Street is complaining again. They want it for free. No handouts for welfare moms, but when bankers screw up, they should get a blank check from the government, no questions asked. My guess is that the Fed wants to prevent a meltdown, but thinks that a slowdown or a mild recession would be good. It would keep the markets from getting complacent or aggressive again, and slower growth would reduce U.S. consumption and imports and help get our foreign accounts closer to balance. For more than 2 years, Wall Street has consistently expected the Fed to be easier than it's been, basically starting with the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, when Wall Street hoped for rate cuts to counter the economic shock of that disaster. Not for New Orleans, of course, for themselves. This presents a problem for populist analyses of the Fed that see the central bank as doing Wall Street's bidding. I've always thought that the Fed had its eye on the broader class struggle and the long-term health of capitalism, and this policy turn only confirms that impression. They seem willing to stop their ears, at least for now, to the pained screams of traders and brokerage house economists. For now, at least. Who knows what's coming? All right, let's take a musical break, and then we'll be back with Tom Gagan.
Meine Hände sind zwei Glocken, bing, bing, bong. Auf deinen Brüsten bringe, frange, bring, bring, brang. Selbst gestreckt noch spüren sie die Rundung und die Knötchen innen dringen, dringe, trong. Avocados, Beeren, Orang-Prikosen? Ach nein, deine Brüste sind wie deine, nur wie deine. Wenn ich Wasser trinke aus der hohlen Hand, werden meine Backen deine Brust.
And that a little bit of Karlheinz Stockhausen's Stimmung, work that premiered in the legendary Time and Place of Paris in 1968, kind of seen as at the time as something of a hippie campfire, as one critic called it. But Karlheinz Stockhausen died 8 days ago, December 5th, and one of the great figures of the period of high modernism in music in the 50s and 60s. He kind of disappeared in the later 70s, but he was composing, but not being paid as much attention to as he was in the 50s and 60s. But I have a record in my collection, which I'm going to exhume and digitize bits of a piece called The Nude Paper Sermon by Eric Salzman, who was the music director of this station in the 1960s. And it's like tape loops and electronic sounds and all sorts of things from those days. It'd be kind of interesting to recover a piece of musical and WBAI history all at once. All right, now we're joined on the line by Tom Gagan, who is a Chicago-based labor lawyer and an author of several books, most recently, See You in Court, How the Right Made America a Lawsuit Nation. Welcome to Behind the News, Tom Gagan.
Thank you, Doc. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, my pleasure. And actually, I have a friend who used to work for Philip Howard, so I have a curious direct connection to this whole story.
Oh.
Yes, so I...
Is Covington and Burling?
No, when he was still running his own firm before he got absorbed by Covington and Burling. So I actually know more about Philip Howard than I should, or most people do. But anyway. Of course, he is famous for claiming that litigation and the lawsuit explosion. And actually, I know from college Wally Olson, who is the one of the litigation experts at the Manhattan Institute. So I have too many personal connections to this to count here. The standard indictment is that liberal courts and activist judges have led to this, and this culture of rights has led to an explosion of litigation that's just costing enormous amounts of money to American business and laying low our competitiveness and all kinds of things like that. You think that story is pretty much exactly wrong, right?
Completely wrong. If anything, the loss of rights by Americans has led to an explosion of litigation. You know, as we've deregulated not just the New Deal, but in a broader sense, deregulated it, made it harder for people to protect their contract rights. And I'm thinking of pension rights in bankruptcy, retiree health insurance in bankruptcy. So we've made it harder to protect rights that people used to take for granted. It's led to more litigation, not less, which may sound paradoxical, but that's why I wrote the book, to explain why. Bankruptcy cases, collection cases, because people are much more vulnerable to collection actions now that they don't have the security of their pensions, the security of their health insurance, and other things.
Well, in a phrase, you could say that these are individualized solutions to collective political and social problems, right?
Yeah. Well, the biggest example that the right likes to point to is the growth of civil rights actions. But those actions in employment situations, you know, where people sue for age discrimination, sex discrimination, is because they no longer have available to them, the way Americans in the 1950s and 60s did, contract arbitration through their unions and collective bargaining and norms of fairness that were in place because the unions with their contracts were around. So this is a case where we've gotten rid of the contracts, the union contracts, all sorts of ways, mainly by making it turning every organizing drive into a bleak house litigation process so that the unions eventually give up. And the result of this has been people desperately looking for other ways to, you know, bring legal actions that are kind of a postmodern response to the disappearance of the old-fashioned labor contract that took care and regulated everything. So as people lose rights, they end up in court more, not less.
Yeah, I must say that when I was reading that portion of the book, I was surprised because I'd never thought about that and certainly hadn't seen anybody make that argument before. But remind us of how things were, not inform us, since very few of us old enough to remember, I guess now, how things used to be done in the old days when there was a dispute at a workplace.
Well, in the old days, everything was regulated by collective bargaining agreements. And by the old days, and this sounds far-fetched to people in 2007, but, you know, in 1958, something close to 40% of the workforce were under these collective bargaining agreements. And that was just, if in the North and Midwest, which is all that counted really back then for GDP purposes, it was much higher than 40%. So people were under a contract, or they were white collar workers who were treated by the same norms, contract norms, as the hourly employees. If you had a dispute, you went to arbitration. It was done. Usually, it was handled in a grievance proceeding between the union and management. Very simple, no lawyers involved. Done in a day, not even done in a day, done in an hour. And the result was, something that both management and the union and the employee could live with. Who
handled those arbitrations?
Business agents, union staffers, shop stewards, non-lawyers. Some of them, very, very, very big ones, of course, back then, were occasionally handled by union in-house lawyers and so forth, but that wasn't out of anybody's pocket. And it was not in the courts, and it was not involved. This is the thing that I really want to emphasize. What's happened in the U.S., it's not just the deregulation of contract law, tort law, pension law, trust law, the loss of all sorts of rights that used to be protected under the old common law. But what's happened is that the trial process has been deregulated. The judges aren't involved in it. It's all done privately through depositions and out-of-court proceedings, hugely expensive and very intrusive. Look what happened to Bill Clinton in the Paula Jones case. What in the world was going on there? Well, it was the deregulation of the trial process. No judge was in the room. There wasn't any rules of evidence that applied in any kind of rational sense. So, Doug, one of the things that I wanted to you know, it's, this book has turned into an answer to the Philip Howard question. But one of the things I really wanted, what I really had in mind when I started writing it, was to explain as this process gets deregulated, not only the law, but the trial process itself, privatized, it becomes more irrational, more maddening, more infuriating, and we have a country where people are going nuts. But it's a product of deregulation, not regulation.
You're talking about depositions. What goes on in these things? Is it pretty much anything goes? Can you ask any kinds of embarrassing questions, and then they get videotaped?
Absolutely. It is the worst experience of my life, you know, defending depositions. I'm usually defending people who are hourly workers of one kind or another against sometimes, not always, but sometimes against corporate lawyers who are making $800 an hour, which they're charging off to their big corporate clients, and asking them about their high school education, where, what was their first job, and what bowling alley did they work in 1967, et cetera, just a bill, and then engage in the worst kind of abuses. And there's nothing I can do about it. You know, I, as any other lawyer who's been in that situation will tell you, you're just observing for human rights violations and not even that.
Why is that not subject to normal rules of evidence and such?
Because the rules have been, because the trial process is deregulated, very few cases go to trial, in federal courts especially, but that's become even more, it's starting to become more true, you know, in the state courts as well. And what happens is that the parties are privatized. This doesn't happen in any other country. It's privatized in the sense that it takes place in law offices where people are being deposed, and they can be deposed for any reason. There's often, you know, in the federal courts, there is at least a rule that you can't keep a witness in a deposition for more than 7 hours. But in that seven-hour period, I've seen people dragged in off the street, sick, lame, breast cancer, suffering, you know, dying, you know, and they're kept there for 7 hours, you know, just beaten up. There really aren't any limits. I suppose if the attorney got up on the other side of the table and walked over and began striking the deponent physically, there's maybe I could protest that. But short of that, occasionally you can instruct a witness not to answer a question if it's privileged. But even the old-fashioned forms of objections that you used to use in court, they're antiquated, so you can't even say objection hearsay or anything like, or relevancy. Nobody does that. You might say form of the question.
So imagine these kinds of situations, who has the most money and the most lawyers usually wins, right?
You guess that, right.
Yeah. I'm speaking with Thomas Gagan, who is the author of the book See You in Court, How the Right Made America a Lawsuit Nation, just out from the New Press. Now, you've got a bit about several things that have changed the country, but you write at some length about the prison explosion. What is the contribution of that?
Oh, I think that the prison explosion is a kind of fallout from the deregulation of the country. You know, the labor law. You know, as a labor lawyer, I really feel that the minimum wage determines to some extent the prison rate. And when it went up in the early 1994 for the first time, and actually as wages went up down to the bottom for the first time, really significantly, crime fell off. And because of that big bump up that we got during the mid-Clinton era, there was a break in this pattern of more and more crime. It's now...
Well, wages have been eroding in the last few years, so we're seeing a rise
in
crime.
And the cycle, I'm afraid, is coming back in a different way. But there's also a way in which I do think that it's created a kind of a culture in this country that has been where we've learned to treat each other fairly abusively. You know, that it's not... It's created a world in which we are taking on more and more of the moral character of prison guards. And I really think Abu Ghraib and things like that are directly related to the U.S. Rate of imprisonment.
Of course, Charles Grader himself was a former prison guard, right?
Yeah. You know, our rate of imprisonment is seven times the world average. And we're in first place. The country that is in second place and is Russia And I suppose the only reason we're a little ahead of them is Russians can't afford to spend $200 billion a year to keep people locked up the way we can.
For that much money, we could fund a fully a universal child care program.
But there's another way, and I talk about it more towards the end of the book. It's not just imprisonment. And this is from a labor lawyer's perspective. It's the disenfranchisement, the criminalization of hourly workers. If you look at the composition of the economy between salaried and hourly workers, it doesn't change that much over time. What has changed over time is the percentage of people who are in hourly workforce who have been disenfranchised because they have prison records or who because they're here illegally in one way or another. So that you've got a situation where in James Madison's Federalist Number 10 sense, where he's looking at the have-nots of faction voting to check the haves, you've got a situation in which there's a shrinking percentage of the have-not faction that is able to go to the polls and vote. The Florida disenfranchisement, of course, is the reason that of people with any kind of felony record is the reason that Bush won, because 600,000 people were disenfranchised because they have these records. So that's a staggering number of people who were potential voters in that election who couldn't vote.
Now, at the opening of the book, you describe a sense that something is really seriously wrong with the way the society is running, the way our democracy is running. And, you know, there are certainly a lot of that perception around. But on the other hand, people are almost anesthetic about it. It's like, things are really messed up, but what you going to do? There's a kind of resignation. Like, why do people tolerate this?
Well, the resignation is part of the crisis. You know, one of the reasons we're such a politically polarized society is that we have so few people voting. I mean, we have one of the lowest voting rates, if not the lowest, of any developed OECD member country, you know, the 20 top countries in terms of economic development. Depending on how you count it and who you're counting and who you're excluding, if you're excluding Dolphins and so forth, we have anywhere from 50 to 60% of the population that votes in presidential elections and far less than that in congressional. Well, it's created a situation where you can't until you bring in the people who are sitting it out to break the deadlock. We're in this kind of deadlock. The only way that the U.S. Constitution, our form of government with its checks and balances, works is if the majority of the country, if eligible voters show up and you can have genuine political majorities developed that can move things along in a progressive direction. If that isn't happening, and it's not happening in the U.S., you have a government and a form of government that is naturally skewed towards directions that aren't consistent with what the nation as a whole want. And that, I think, is what is the ultimate explanation for the frustration people get when people did participate in the process, when they were voting at rates of 70 and 80%. There were so many checks and balances that the system wasn't working. The Senate, for example, has been, with the filibuster, is a way of frustrating the majority. So people drop out. And you start to have the government becoming more and more disengaged and detached from the real America. So that there are two Americas. There's this real America, which is lovable and everybody thinks is wonderful and is cute and has soft power and everyone around the world loves. And then there's this strange American government, which seems, you know, like a Frankenstein monster, disconnected from the people. Well, until you get the people to come back in and start voting in numbers that are at European-type levels, you know, 80% is in France in the last election, you're going to have this disconnect between who we are as a people and who our government is. That's what I'm trying to get at in the book.
Yeah, and you say at one point that the Constitution has a depressing effect on our democratic life, which is, I have to say, a surprising phrase coming from a liberal lawyer, because you usually get reverence for the Constitution. You also say that some of our state constitutions are more modern than our federal constitution. How is the Constitution a check on or a depressing effect on democratic life?
Well, for the same reason that the founders thought it was. James Madison almost walked out of the Constitutional Convention because he said it's not a republic. The biggest problem, not the only problem, but the biggest problem is the structure of the Senate. And this is very hard to sell to people on the left because they love the Senate. They love the filibuster. They
not
love
me.
To see the filibuster of John
Roberts. You can bash the Senate all you want. Well, for me.
Yeah. And it's just been so destructive and so awful. I mean, we would look like a European social democracy, Sweden, Germany, Netherlands today, but for the U.S. Senate, which was put in place to protect slavery, and it now protects kind of low-wage operations. Labor law reform has been killed repeatedly in the Senate, where you have filibuster voting, of course, on all of this, and you have a system where, you know, ultimately senators representing 9% of the population would be enough to shoot down a bill. Well, with that kind of check, and likewise, by the way, senators representing 16% of the population can be a majority to pass a bill. Now, the system doesn't work out that to that extreme, but it does allow for these disproportionate regional vetoes, especially from the South, which has just absolutely killed over the decades any chance for the U.S. from moving from New Deal type system we had in the 1950s and 60s to a kind of modern European social democracy. If you look at other countries, they have modern, up-to-date constitutions, which are based on one person, one vote. The U.S. is not based on one person, one vote. Remember South Africa? We were against apartheid. We were against the white regime. We wanted one person, one vote. We don't have that in the U.S. It's the only major democratic government, so-called democratic government in the world, that is not based on one person, one vote. And a lot of this is because of provisions and things in the Constitution which are held dear by people on the left in this country. It's very paradoxical.
Well, we've only got a minute or so left, but the Senate cannot be abolished without the unanimous consent of every state, and those little states are not going to agree to it. So are we stuck?
You know, that's a provision, and that's been quoted to me a couple of times. That's just a provision in the contract that we have, our Constitution, that says it can't be changed unless by majority rule. You know how you change that in the law? You had another provision saying we're going to change that procedure. The procedure itself doesn't have to be, you don't need unanimous vote to change the procedure that requires unanimous vote. Do you see my point? It's just
you can do it without amending the Constitution?
I'm a lawyer. I know a lawyer's way out of this. That's not...
So you can do it without amending the Constitution?
Oh, well, you would have to amend the Constitution,
right.
But you wouldn't have to get unanimous approval.
Right, you just get the usual three-quarters.
But what you could do, starting right now, forget amending the Constitution. People will... Their eyes will glaze over. That'll never happen, et cetera. Of course not. But at least in the interim. But you could get rid of the filibuster tomorrow. Be easy to do. The Democrats had a chance to do it when the Republicans came in and said they were going to nuke the filibuster unless you back off. And, you know, I mean, all sorts of people that I revere in the Senate on the Democratic side stood up and said, well, we can't give up the filibuster. Of course you can. And that is something that there should be teach-ins on campuses right now. What's stopping labor law reform, what's creating the plutocracy here is, believe it or not, and it will be much clearer in the next Democratic administration, is the filibuster. Get rid of it.
Well, that's a good note to end on. Thank you for joining us, Tom Gagin. It's a very important book. See you in court, just out from the New Press. Thank you for all your work over the years, and hope you sell lots of copies and influence a whole generation of people with this. Thanks for joining us. Let's take a little break for station ID, and we'll be back with Greg Grandin.
Don't tell me to stop. Tell the rain not to drop. Tell me everything I'm not. Don't tell me to stop.
Hi, this is Liz Wright. You're listening to WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
And this is WBAI, which is not only at 99.5 on your FM dial in New York City, but on the web at WBAI.org. And please do check out our website for all kinds of ever-changing and expanding delights. And let's take a little bit of a musical break, a little more Stockhausen while I go fetch Greg Grandin. And that a bit from Karlheinz Stockhausen in honor of his life and who recently died on the 5th of December. That a bit from his Kontakte für elektronische Klänge, Klavier und Schlagzeug. I love German. Schlagzeug, percussion, a hit thing, literally in German, for electronic sounds, piano, and percussion. And that from, I believe, 1959 or 1960. Pretty old now, but that was high modernism for you. We're now joined in the studio by Greg Grandin, who is a professor of Latin American history at NYU and author most recently of...
Empire's Workshop.
Empire's Workshop, yes. That's in the Empire series, right?
From, yeah, American Empire series, Henry Holt.
From Henry Holt.
Metropolitan.
Metropolitan Books, right. That was the word I was looking for. Well, we had you here a few weeks ago to give the, or a few months ago, to give the kind of political tour guide of Latin America, the left-wing rebellion that... I deliberately minimized the coverage of Venezuela because that was the kind of star, and I wanted to hear how everybody knew that something was going on in
Guerrilla
Venezuela,
in the room.
But I wanted to focus on some of the other stuff that was going on. But now, since, of course, a few weeks ago we had that referendum, and Hugo took it on the chin in that referendum, but I thought it was a good time to talk about what has been going on there, what's going to happen, what's your evaluation of where it's going, and... what is this very what appears to be a very momentous political development that's been going on in the southern part of this hemisphere for many years now? What's it all mean? So first of all, what's your reading of the rejection of the constitutional changes?
Yeah, well, just to put in a little context, exactly a year ago, Chavez was reelected with something with 7.3 million votes, 63% of the electorate, with 75% turnout. And he ran on a program of doing exactly what he did. Say what you want about Chavez. He doesn't pull his punches. He lets you know what he's going to do, unlike, you know, most Latin American or most politicians in general. And they run on these anti-neoliberal programs, and then they implement it when they get in. Chavez said he was going to issue, he's going to propose a constitutional amendment that would let him run again, strengthen the executive branch. Not only did he do that, he issued something like 33 proposals, and then the National Assembly added another 36 for a total of 69 proposals, and it was a grab bag of any number of things, from very progressive things that nobody on the left could have a problem with, and lowering the work week, providing Social Security for the informal sector, gender and sexual preference discrimination, doing away with it, and doing away with discrimination on race and political preference, political association. But then the most controversial stuff was strengthening the executive branch, not just doing away with term limits, which would allow him to run again, but basically solidifying a model that he's been fairly open about what he wants to do, and that is a greatly empowered citizenship, and then a strengthened, emboldened executive branch that can carry out, that can redistribute wealth, regulate the economy, and conduct a fairly independent foreign policy. And many of the reforms were designed to do that. And what happened was that the reforms were voted down by very close, less than 1%, 50.3 to 49.7 or something like that.
In some ways,
100,000 votes or something.
In some ways, it's better that that happened than if it won by that kind of margin, right?
What he said. He said he wouldn't want to. I mean, when he came out, he pretty much acknowledged that he wouldn't want that. But what seems to have happened is that a lot of his base just didn't vote. I mean, obviously, there's going to have to be a lot of polling data has to be analyzed, and it's beyond my expertise. But it seems like a lot of his, he lost basically 3 million votes within a year, and the participation was 55%. So a lot of people just stayed at home.
Now, this was a big deal, so you can't say it was just apathy.
Yes.
Was it that people just didn't want to vote against it?
Well, I think you have to break it down a little bit, and I would suggest that, you know, obviously this 35% of the electorate that wouldn't vote for Chavez or anything that he proposed to be on no matter what. But then I think that you could break it down between those who were – there's a good part of his base that actually felt threatened by these reforms, because you have to think of Chavismo, or the political movement that Chavez stands nominally as a head of, is a very loose coalition, and it has in some ways rhetorical and institution and rhetorical and electoral hegemony, at least until recently, but not institutional hegemony. He's had to make a lot of compromises with outgoing with power blocks within the military, the civil bureaucracy, the foreign service, the education, you know, the social service bureaucracy, and a lot of, you know, political parties, and a lot of these kind of party bosses and political kind of political operatives have used Chavismo to increase their power, and in many ways they saw this as a threat. And so a lot of the many of the reforms were designed to strengthen communal councils at a lower level, at a local level, which was clearly designed to weaken municipal power and even state level power. And it seems like they didn't mobilize Chavistas to the degree that they did a year ago. And I'd say that there was also another block of people who probably didn't vote or voted no that are nominally Chavistas, who are concerned about some aspect of the reform. Again, there were 69 reforms, and it's almost impossible to say.
About that issue? They were all presented as a single package, up or down.
Two packages, up or down, which turned out to be a tactical blunder. I mean, it was designed in order to kind of, you know, to be honest, to ram it through, get it out of the way, and then move on. And it turned out, I mean, you couldn't have imagined if you set out to design a series of reforms that would alienate different sectors of your base, and then tell them that they had to vote yes or no. You know, obviously, it brought together a coalition, at least a temporary coalition of opposition that voted against it. So obviously there was another percentage, I'd say, that were concerned about some aspect within. And then I think there was also another protest vote or protest non-vote that, you know, Chavez. I think to some degree that Chavez is enormously popular. He's still, even opposition polls still give him 60% of the vote, but he has to. His government needs to learn how to administer. I mean, there's been this enormous redistribution of wealth. Money's been pouring into the barrios and all of these new missions, healthcare missions, education missions. But in some ways, just the bread and butter, learning how to actually govern is something that I think that in some ways this may have been a protest. Crime is incredibly high. It's something like 20. I heard some incredible figure, 20,000 murders in Venezuela over the last year. It's like it's a bloodbath, and there's corruption. So I think there's a lot of people who felt like maybe the ideals of, and they wanted a little less lofty rhetoric about 21st century socialism and more bread and butter issues, even though they may have enormously benefited from the massive redistribution of wealth in the country.
Did a lot of the technocrats administrators leave? So are they suffering from an erosion of talent?
Yeah. Well, erosion may be a little strong. It depends. It's arguable how competent they were prior to the Chavez. You know, it's a Latin American. I mean, you know, there has been, in the oil sector, for instance, the oil strike led to flight. Quite a number of the people who opposed Chavez, PDVSA, the state oil company, which technically was a state-run industry, but it was not run as a private industry. For the first 6 years of Chavez's presidency, there was a struggle over control of it. Chavez has been in control of PDVSA, the oil company, only for the last three and a half, four years. And that strike did lead to a lot of technocrat flight. I think that you look in the foreign service bureaucracy, Chavez has had to rely on a lot of up until recently, the ambassador to London was writing weekly columns in the opposition press denouncing the government. I mean, you know, it's displaying a level of ideological plurality you would never have in this country.
But we also have a pretty deep foreign service to work with.
Yes, there has been flight. There has been there hasn't been a strong administrative structure in which Chavismo. It didn't come to power through a protracted revolution that can count on an ideologically coherent cadre or that it could rely on. It's had to make significant compromises with existing power blocks, and that has meant that struggles, political struggles that in an insurgency or revolution that would have been settled early on have been kind of dragged out and prolonged over the last 8 years. So what's often described as Chavez's power grabs are really manifestations of this ongoing attempt to define and provide some kind of coherence to what is Chavismo, and these referendums were supposed to be a milestone in that, and obviously it was a strategic blunder in some ways.
That's the voice of Greg Grandin, a professor of Latin American history at NYU and author most recently of Empire's Workshop from Metropolitan Books. There is a very profound conundrum, to use a word that Alan Greenspan loves, in that, you know, I certainly don't want to go as far as the ISO or your average anarchist in this, but, you know, there is this risk of developing a cult of personality. And certainly there's a lot about this that could be interpreted as an aggrandizement of executive power that would make some people nervous. At the same, you know, but then the purists say we need pure grassroots. You know, everything must come up from the grassroots. But on the other hand, we wouldn't be talking about any of this if it weren't for the figure of Hugo Chavez. Because, I mean, he is obviously a very skilled, intelligent, and a charismatic politician. So how do we balance this kind of, you know, this individual, what could then degenerate into an impulse towards authoritarianism, with actually getting something done at the same time we don't get carried away with this kind of, you know, slide towards dictatorship? I mean, how do we think this through?
Well, I think one thing, in terms of the specificity of Venezuelan history, the old party system, the duopoly that existed in Venezuela prior to the ascendance of Chavez, was so discredited. Party politics and a certain kind of deep personalized political culture that wasn't based around a cult of personality has been so discredited that there is an emergence of one person as opposed to Chavez has been very hesitant about creating a political party. He has recently, but he's always kind of mediating behind. You have to think of Chavismo as both a political coalition and a coalition of social movements. And Chavez functions more as a mediator between these different political and social blocks. He's also very skilled at fending off the opposition, who obviously, you know, a lot of the advances of the progressive aspects of Chavismo is largely because of his skill as a politician. I think that there's a certain understanding and relationship. If you go into the barrios, into the urban the neighborhoods that are the base of Chavez, or into the countryside, I think they have, without romanticizing it, they do have a very sophisticated understanding of their relationship to Chavez. And again, you do have to distinguish between Chavistas who are merely sympathetic and have voted for Chavez, and then Chavistas who are actually organized in social movements and cooperatives and communal councils through community radio stations. And I think that latter group, the Chavistas who are socially organized and social movements, have a much more complex understanding of their relationship to Chavez. And it's a common phrase to say that we'll be with Chavez as long as Chavez is with the people. Now, that said, it's obviously a political problem that so much is dependent on one person. And one could hope that this, and Chavez is very skilled, and I think Chavismo has deep roots, and it is resilient. And unlike the Sandinistas, who when they lost election, they were voted out, Chavez has 5 more years in power, so there's a little bit of wiggle room that hopefully they'll come out of this. And there will be an institutionalization of the grassroots in a way that isn't so dependent on Chavez. But I just want to say one other quick thing. You know, there is the ISO position, which would take this as a victory for democracy, that this, you know, and they would say that this means they've got to empower the communal councils even more and the grassroots even more. But I think there's some truth to that, but I also think it is true that Chavismo as a government has to learn how to administer and provide basic social services in a competent way. It's less about empowering the communal councils or the cooperatives and learning how to figure out how to cut crime and rein in corruption.
Well, it's certainly very hard to make a revolution and keep the electricity running at the same time.
Yeah.
So it's very easy to sit in New York City and make complaints about things other people are doing, but it's really, really hard. So I think it doesn't hurt to make that point often. Well, what is going on with that? I'm sorry if my cold is getting the better of my voice. But what is going on at that grassroots level? I've heard a lot about development schemes and community organizations and such, but give us a picture of what is the Chavez regime doing at that level to spread around some of the resources the oil company, for example, brings in? And also, you know, what kind of educational health efforts are going on.
Right. Well, there's two things. One is the missions, the social missions, the education missions, the healthcare. Misión Barrio Adentro means inside the neighborhood, which is the healthcare mission, which provides basic communal clinics, about one for every 300 families. I mean, you walk through Caracas and you see these octagonal red brick buildings, and it's quite amazing. And, you know, every time I've been there and I've stopped by one unannounced, you know, it was amazing how clean and how well-functioning they were. They're staffed by Cuban doctors, and the idea is that they'll train local Venezuelan doctors and something along the lines of there was 2,000 physicians for the population, for 20 million Venezuelans in 1998, and now there's something like 20,000. So there's that kind of massive spending. There's the education missions, and then there's the housing missions. And that's a kind of, in some ways, just a classic redistribution of wealth and the oil wealth that's coming out of the country. Social spending has increased 170% per capita since 1998 to 2006, 2007. It's an enormous infusion of money and resources. But then there's also the grassroots organization, social movements organized around community radio, community media, which are much more than just the creating ways of communication and getting information out. These are training facilities and cultural centers within neighborhoods. There's the cooperative movement, and something like 6% of Venezuelan employment is now in cooperatives. Last figure I heard was between 800,000 and 900,000 people work in some form of cooperatives, worker councils. They're also trying to create industrial centers outside of Caracas. This is, in some ways, this is the some of the more dicey stuff, but in an effort to create to further industrialization, but also stem the massive influx into the city. Venezuela is one of the most urbanized Latin American countries, and has been for a while. The growth of the informal sector, and not just in Caracas, but in a lot of these provincial cities, is just enormous. So the idea is, I mean, nominally the idea is to reverse the flow, but if they could just slow it down and create, and so they're pouring money into these kind of agricultural factory in the field kind of things. That'll be making tractors and things like that. So
there's always the risk of building white elephants. So
yeah.
You have to be very careful with that stuff. One worries sometimes that if they use the oil company as a piggy bank, then they won't reinvest in the machinery of oil production, and that will eventually run down. What's going on with that?
Well, you know, everybody has an opinion on that, and I'm not an expert, and there was just that article by Tina Rosenberg in the New York Times. But, you know, everything one could say about Chavez has to always be talked about in comparison. The idea that PDVSA was not corrupt and not inefficient. I know there's a kind of, oftentimes there's an opposition created between PDVSA under Chavez and PDVSA when it was this efficient, you know, semi-privatized oil company. But it seems like that, you know, most oil companies have signed these joint operating agreements. ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips haven't, but 30-something companies have. In the Orinoco Belt, with the heavy crude, if that's taken into account, Venezuela has some of the largest reserves in the country. Money seems to be pouring in. And production is up. I mean, production seems to be maintained on a steady basis. There's some criticism that it's not as high as it used to be prior to the oil strike, but it's unclear that they actually want it to be that high. I mean, they may want, you know, there's no, I mean, Chavez is famously trying to keep production on a certain level in order to keep oil prices high. So I don't know if there's much evidence that money isn't being invested in the oil sector any less than it was when it was effectively privatized.
And now, finally, what does the defeat of this referendum mean for the future of Chavismo? How serious a blow is it? Can they recover? Will they actually come back stronger? What do you think?
Well, again, among certain sectors of the left and the progressive community that's sympathetic to Chavismo, there was an immediate knee-jerk reaction to say that this is a good thing, that it'll force it to democratize or institutionalize itself. And I think that's...
They weren't undemocratic to begin with.
They weren't undemocratic to begin with, yes. But that it would democratize even more and create mechanisms, a mediation that went beyond Chavez's personal skills between these social movements and political organizations. And I think that that's very possible, but I also think it is a significant blow. I mean, I think Chavez does have to figure out a way to reestablish that he has majority support. So I don't know how he goes about doing that. There's some talk already of reintroducing the proposals, but have them being really debated at the grassroots and having them convening these kind of grassroots social movement conventions and having them present whatever proposals that they think are either revised set of proposals or selected set of proposals. And as a way of kind of really reaffirming that Chavismo does have majority support. I think that's the first goal. But I think the opposition may sense blood. The opposition has been notoriously fragmented and infighting and without a positive program of administration. This may give them a sense that they may group around these so-called democratic students that were held up.
And what about this guy named Stalin, the Wall Street Journal?
Stalin, yes, I know. And, you know, he had to have been born after 53. So
yeah.
That gives you after Khrushchev's speech in 56, he had to have been born after. After that, so
yeah.
It gives you a sense of his family's pedigree, at least. I mean, you know, I'm sure a lot of these students were motivated by sincere concerns, but they were also, I think, I don't think you can divorce them from the larger context in which they both saw their rights threatened. Los Angeles Times had a quote by one of them talking about they want to you know, the reforms want to allow custodians to elect the rectors of the university. It's a classic, they want to take our rights by extending rights to others kind of thing. I think what you'll see the opposition starting to group around the students and whether they can maintain any sense of unity or come up with a positive program. The Constitution as it stands allows the opposition to submit a recall referendum after a politician's midpoint in his or her tenure. So in 2 years, they could do that for Chavez. I mean, that could actually backfire on them if they try to do that. I think that the opposition has given the opposition a kind of X-ray of Chavismo's weaknesses and vulnerabilities. And then also, more importantly, he lost a number of more you could call them moderates, or maybe some of them were opportunists, some of them were moderates, Chavistas, who were governors of certain key states that are now effectively not in the coalition, and how he's able to negotiate between reestablishing the fact that Chavismo has majority support while at the same time addressing some of these bread and butter issues of administration and crime, I think are going to be the key problem that he has to figure out and the people around him have to figure out.
All right, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us, Greg Grandin. Greg Grandin is a professor of Latin American history at NYU and author most recently of the book Empire's Workshop, about how Latin America is kind of the experimental site for American imperialism, and has been for quite a long time. That's it for me, Doug Hedwood. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening, and let's go out with this great new song by a Chicago band called Busy Signals. This is Plastic Girl. This is a timeless bit of power pop. Could have come out any time in the last 25 years, but it just came out in October. Till next week. Bye.